Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
It is episode 96 and it is the 12th of February. We've got a fantastic show for you guys coming up. We're going to be talking to Dr. Stephen Hicks. He is a really, really cool thinker about the postmodernist movement and he's going to be in Australia with True Arrow events coming up in a few weeks' time. So we're going to be talking to him about postmodernism, its effect on universities and what he's seeing from young people around the world. This guy is a very, very cool thinker. It was a really good interview.
It's a great interview, and also I must say I'm very excited to be creeping up towards episode 100.
We need to start planning what we're actually going to be doing.
I think we'll start planning.
We'll start planning 2 hours before we start.
Yep.
And it won't be that good, but we'll have fun.
Yeah, we'll have lots of great ideas that we can't do because we left it too late. No, yep. Just kidding. It's going to be great.
It's going to be a lot of fun. And we are also going to be talking to Andrew Bushnell, IPA Research Fellow here, about his new article, upcoming new report, and he's got a pretty good rant about the Oscars, which I had a little teaser of, and I wanted to get him on the show to talk about it. So look forward to that.
Loves a rant.
This guy loves a rant and he loves movies. But not some of the movies that got nominated for an Oscar. So tune in for that. All right. But if I may start the show on a somber note.
This is
a very somber note.
A sad day.
This is a very sad day for me. Tony Jones is stepping down from Q&A.
Our favourite host of our favourite show.
This is going to be a rare moment where I get to play two of my favourite sound effects on the show. Both a Q&A clap and Time of Your Life by Greg.
Oh! I knew you were going to say that.
Okay. Thank you.
And I don't know what to do about it, Pete. I'm very sad.
Well, there's a few things we should say. You know, Tony Jones, our favourite host, after 11 years of Q&A, has told the Australian that he's stepping down.
Yep.
And he's going to China.
Yep.
To write thriller novels.
Film it there. Fly them all out. Fly the audience out. Fly the guests out. Film it there. I'm not saying it's over. I'm not saying it's over.
You've got to let go, mate.
I'm not.
You've got to let
Nothing's over, Pete.
And he's writing the sequel to his novel. He's got a novel called The 20th Man, which I didn't know. My apologies. And he's going to write a sequel to it, which he describes as a Day of the Jackal type thriller.
The 21st Man.
With plenty more sequels planned.
22nd Man. This is just what I would call
it. Go on
it.
Forever.
So they are now discussing who is going to replace Tony Jones. No one can replace Tony Jones at Q&A. No one's going to balance all the things that a necessary Q&A host has to have.
Mm-hmm.
But Virginia Trioli is the favourite. There's also like Hamish McDonald's getting thrown out and a few other people. I reckon we should do it.
When you said you're reading out the favourites, I thought, okay, well, here it comes.
12 to 1, 15 to 1.
You know, two hosts, not one, because a lot of work.
Yep, that's a lot of responsibility to bear.
Yep, we're likable guys.
Yep.
The Ultimo set will get around us.
Yes.
And I think that we should be right in there in the hunt.
All right. And Nina's there as well.
Well,
Nina's there for when the crowd gets out of hand.
I'll be the ones like, clap people, clap. you don't even have.
They have to edit that out when Tony does that.
Start shaking his fists.
I was like, do threads, it.
Threads to walk into the crowd. Don't make me come down there again.
I reckon Lena Lowe and Arthur, shining new era.
All right, to be honest, I reckon you and I should withdraw our names for the hat and we can center around Nina as a campaign.
Save ourselves the embarrassment.
Yeah, we need to drop off the nomination just so Nina can become the one true host of Q&A. Nina, can I get you to give your own sort of like Q&A clap? Like we've all heard the Q&A clap sound effect. Nina, what would you like? Say the audience started clapping at a time that you didn't think was inappropriate. You didn't think was appropriate. You thought someone had more to say.
Yeah.
And Pete and I are going to start clapping. You're going to tell us to wind it up politely.
Stop it, guys. Thank you. Let's continue.
A chill just went down my spine.
She's going to rule with an iron fist.
All right,
I actually had a chill as well.
Okay, so official podcast.
Yeah, that
notes.
Was the rush of power.
What you just had will guide you to great, great things and terrible things. I'm putting this in show notes. We're going to get Nina to host Q&A. Yeah.
Didn't realize that we had show notes, but that's good.
I'm writing it on my current notes. Host Q&A. Done. All right.
Motion passed.
Motion passed. Motion carried. Your move finishing your Trioli.
Yeah. That's going to be a good competition. All right.
All right, cool. Should we get into an actual news story?
That was a new story.
God damn it. It's still real to me.
We're going to have to do a new sound effect as well. All right. Put that in the show notes. So recently we told you about the Humberside docker who got a call from local police to check his thinking after he posted a limerick on Twitter about transgender people. Now we have a woman called Kate Scotto from Hitchin in Hertfordshire in England in the UK again, arrested in front of her children and locked up for 7 hours after referring to a transgender woman as a man online. Three officers detained Kate at her home before quizzing her at a police station about an argument. And more than 2 months after her arrest on December 1, she's yet to receive her laptop and phone back, which is obviously inconvenient. Kate says, I was arrested in my home by three officers with my autistic 10-year-old daughter and breastfed 20-month-old son present. I was then detained for 7 hours in a cell with no sanitary products, which I said I needed before being interviewed, then later released upon investigation. I was arrested for harassment and malicious communication because I called someone out and misgendered them on Twitter. Hertfordshire Police said, we take all reports of malicious communication seriously.
Well, yes, they do.
They take them very seriously.
If there's one thing I know, it is that arrest, like those complaints are taken very seriously by Hertfordshire Police. At what point when you arrest someone for posting something online and their 7-year-old autistic daughter is watching... Oh, sorry, 10-year-old autistic daughter is watching...
Son.
You just misgender everyone.
Hertfordshire Police is knocking down that door right now.
Yep.
Anyway, at what point in this whole story do you as a police officer go, this ain't what I signed up for?
Well, yeah, that's the way, I always think about that with this stuff for the cops. They're like, you know, ready to get murderers off the street.
Yeah, going to clean up the streets, going to make sure people are safe to walk around.
Yep.
It's like, actually, and then there was this other story of this 74-year-old Margaret Nelson in the village in Suffolk.
Ipswich.
I've got Suffolk.
Ipswich is in Suffolk.
Why would you try and well actually me?
Because you said it was a village and it's not.
Oh, geez. All right. Someone knows about
Ipswich
England.
Town, mate. Ipswich Town. Used to be in the Premier League.
Cut it out, guys.
I really researched this piece.
I'm done with you.
Listen to me and all my facts. Yeah, right. Go on.
But I'm just saying, like, is that to go arrest Margaret Nelson? Who signed up for the police to go arrest Margaret Nelson?
Yeah, that's right. So 74-year-old Margaret Nelson. And she didn't even have, like, this. The first person was someone who was arguing with a transgender person on Twitter and calling her stuff.
Yeah.
Margaret Nelson just has a blog,
which
you can not read if you don't want to.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
Are you also allowed to just not check your Twitter notifications?
Yeah, you are.
Oh, really?
You are allowed to do that. You're allowed to not have Twitter. I've heard.
Wow.
So Margaret said, as far as I'm concerned, so this is the 75-year-old woman, as far as I'm concerned, I'm just stating facts. It won't stop me from doing so. I received a warning that I had upset people and asking me to tone things down. I've since received a phone call apologising and saying police got it all wrong. So good on you, Margaret, for not backing down. That's that British bulldog spirit that we love. The other thing about her thing was, so she's just arguing about this change they're considering making to the Gender Recognition Act in the UK. So she's just advocating for the law as it currently stands.
Right.
And for that, you can get.
So, should every single member of the British House of Commons be arrested by Hertfordshire Police?
On that basis.
Yeah. It's going to be a hell of a sting operation.
Well.
But they know where they are.
They're
in the House of Commons.
They know where they work.
Yes. Cool. All right. I'm going to talk about this story. This one got a little out of hand, as stories involving Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez often do.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, this week, last Thursday, she released the Green New Deal, which is her big. Legislative platform for her first role. And this is just how much real estate Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has in the Democrat Party. Mm-hmm. Like, without even reading it, it got the approval of Senator Cory Booker, Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, apologies for mispronouncing a future president's name, and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. All of those people are running for president, and all of them are like, yeah, this Green New Deal rules.
Yeah, well, there you go.
So this is a pretty big thing.
It is.
Except when people started reading it, they were like, hang on, there's a few things that aren't exactly adding up here. So the big one, the one that got all the stories was there was this like frequently asked questions document, which the Ocasio-Cortez team put on the website.
The old FAQs,
which were summarizing the legislation. And I don't wish to, throw your perceptions of what's happened here, but a lot of journalists just read the FAQs and just went with the story. They didn't really bother to read through the actual legislation.
Yep.
And the FAQs insinuated that in 10 years' time, America was just going to stop using coal and oil and just non-renewable energy resources.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to phase out air travel because it was just going to be high-speed rail. Bad news for Hawaii. Hope you guys got food and water over there.
Alaska.
Because it's going to get pretty tough for you guys.
Guam.
Yeah, Guam and Hawaii. Alaska, you can at least go through Canada, get some sort of agreement. But that is a hell of a highway to build from California to Hawaii. Like, that's a big construction network.
Yeah.
And then a whole bunch of other stuff. And that really, like, you know, all the conservative news outlets, it's catnip whenever Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez does anything.
Yeah.
They started freaking out, talking about, you know, this can't be real, this can't happen, which it can't. And anyway, the FAQ document got taken down. Apparently, it was a draft version.
Yep.
So, you know, those classic things where you release an important document to your website and this thing that's getting criticized happens to be a draft version. My bad.
I don't want to.
How did this happen?
Is that possible that could happen?
It's possible, but it's like.
Check with the team in legal.
What an absolute coincidence that the draft version that got criticized all around the world just happened to be a draft version that wasn't supposed to be real. So, pretty funny, Pete.
Oh, mate, I think that she said, you know, that in the meeting they said, look, Alexandria, we can't just roll back the industrial age. And she said, hold my beer. And she went for it.
Very relatable content by you there.
Maybe this is...
Hold my beer.
Yeah, yeah. So I saw that on the internet. And maybe this is a negotiating tactic. Maybe it's just this is her ambit offer, right? And then from this point, she'll negotiate.
At this point with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, like everything she does is part of a plan. Like she's indestructible. Everything she does, she turns into a win. She's the left's Trump.
Really?
Like, every time there's more hatred of her, the profile just grows. Like I reckon she's like legitimately the most famous Democrat there is right now. Like she can't run for president because she's not over 35, but she's more famous than any of them.
But she's the woman who said we're going to close down all the airports in America. 5,000 airports.
Yeah. But like Trump said, I could shoot someone in the middle of New York City and my pulse would go up. Like we're past the days of like this statement will kill this politician. No statement kills any politician anymore.
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know what else I got to say about this.
All right, I got one more to say about this. Ocasio-Cortez spokesman Corbin Trent was asked about like the FAQs referred to.
That's right. There's this whole thing with that.
Yeah, they referred to like phasing out air travel and phasing out cows.
Yeah, cows because they're cows. Flatulent.
Exactly. Lol. By the way, good flatulent drop on the podcast.
Lol.
So Ocasio-Cortez spokesman Corbin Trent said it's literally clearly irony.
Yeah.
Good excuse. I would have gone with, we got hacked, but to just say, guys, it's irony. How do you not get that? Do you just not get my highbrow sense of comedy?
Yeah.
Do you not even watch Rick and Morty?
Yeah. Like, well, I mean, fart jokes are pretty highbrow. So, No, I don't. But there's also the thing that was going around that was doctored, wasn't it?
There was one that was doctored, which referred to like a national program to use reusable urine.
Yeah.
Which, didn't really pass the pub test.
That one was not real.
Yeah, that was...
Okay.
All right, cool.
Well, an important point about this, actually, and I should mention this just before we move on, that she said that she was basically, to pay for this, the printing of more cash is definitely in the conversation. That's modern monetary theory.
How has no one ever thought of that?
I don't know.
Print more cash.
This is why, you know, this is why she's so popular.
We should do that out of our backyard.
Do you know, here's a story for the listeners. That's off.
As your lawyer... Do you want to tell a story?
But my great grandfather was transported to Australia for counterfeit.
Counterfeit money?
Yeah, no stealing of the cucumbers for the Gregories.
If he only waited 200 years, it could have been the central monetary theory.
Yeah.
Of his time.
He got bloody transported for that.
He's a trailblazer, a leader in his field.
Yeah. So there's that. And anyway.
All right.
I'll leave the rest of it. There is more. I'll save that for future episodes. So the other thing that's been going on at the moment is PragerU has officially filed a new lawsuit over the weekend against tech giant Google and its subsidiary YouTube in the state of California. So they already had a currently pending appeal in the Ninth Circuit, whatever court.
You don't know.
which is a court. PragerU
and a circuit.
is now doubling down in California state court, continuing the fight for free speech online for all Americans and calling for YouTube to end its restriction of over 80 PragerU videos. PragerU says YouTube continues to restrict access to more and more of our videos simply because they present a conservative point of view. There are currently over 80 PragerU videos that have been restricted. So, and 500,000 Americans have signed an online petition urging Google to end its censorship.
So what do you reckon about this?
I don't even reckon they're... Like, I don't even support their law thing. Like, I think... YouTube should be able to show whatever videos they want.
Yeah.
But I think it's good that they're raising this issue that these tech giants that you think are like these kind of neutral bodies are massively ideological.
If that's what this is, and it's literally just raise a profile and get YouTube to change, then I'm all for it. But, you know, down the line the courts are like, oh, yeah, Google and YouTube don't, like, they have to, you know, have all... viewpoints that the government says it should have on its platform. That's a little weird.
It's like suing New York Times for not running your piece.
Yeah. It's like, well, what happens if you win? Like, that's a bit more chilling to me than Yeah. I don't know. Like, that's true. If the whole thing is just getting attention, good. But if this actually gets to courts and something happens.
Yeah. I mean, surely it won't get up. I'm no legal eagle expert. So, you know,
except
surprise, surprise.
Matter of counterfeit law.
Except for that. But I don't think it would get up. But it's good that people realise. And clearly, you know, these things need to be diversified. We need new platforms that are either liberal or conservative or just neutral, like genuinely neutral.
Yeah. The other censorship story this week, which I thought was interesting, was a bunch of Twitter users who are now getting their accounts blocked for tweeting learn to code at journalists.
Yeah.
That's a, like, if we can't have that stand, what can we have?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So basically what this was, if you missed it, so when a whole lot of coal mines were shutting down around the US, a lot of journalists would write articles like, oh, teaching coal miners to code. And it was a bit like their version of let them eat cake. Mm-hmm. Like, you've got this people who've worked for 40 years in one industry and it's like, oh, just go to Silicon Valley, learn to code, you'll be fine, you know. Tough. Mm-hmm. You call the mine closed down. So when HuffPost and BuzzFeed went under, or their opinion sections went under, some people were like, oh, maybe you should learn to code. And like, the first one is journalism, and then the second one is unbelievable abuse that must be blocked on Twitter.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. And like, they rely.
It's where you're tweeting from. If you're tweeting from the desk of a journalism website, you're fine. If you're tweeting from a basement, that's it for you.
That's
you're
right. Done.
All right, so that is it for stuff at the start of the show this week. So we'll now go to those interviews with Stephen Hicks and Andrew Bushnell. But before we do, guys, thank you so much for listening to the IPA podcast, and thank you so much for subscribing. We're available on iTunes and every good podcast app, so make sure you're telling your friends and family about the show.
When are we going to get banned?
Do you want to get banned? Let's get deplatformed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Deplatformed.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and then we get to live out our dream of having Alex Jones on the podcast, because that's our icebreaker, is we just say, hey, we've both been deplatformed.
I wouldn't mind, I don't like everything, but just one or two of the early episodes just taken offline.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, you actually want to get banned. I thought you were doing it for notoriety,
just
because the Bad Boys of podcasting.
Just for the notoriety, not for any other reason.
Oh, right, okay. So, okay, cool. I was like, what did we say in our first few episodes?
No, I mean nothing.
All right.
Of consequence.
Nothing. In fact, we could have said that to every episode we've done.
Yeah.
We've never said anything of consequence. All right, so where was I before Pete rudely interrupted me with a trip down memory lane? So thank you. If you are listening through iTunes, make sure you're leaving us that 5-star review. You can also leave a comment for the show. You know what a good comment would be? Hashtag make Nina host of Q&A.
Yeah, let's start.
Or just some form of that.
The people's movement.
There's a lot of letters going on in that hashtag.
The people's host.
Nina for QA. Nina for QA. That is the official hashtag.
What about the people's host?
The people's host, Nina for Q&A. So comment on that and maybe tweet it as well. Let's get a groundswell movement happening. We're going to get there. I believe it. Yeah. We've also got the IPA's Looking Forward podcast. That is out as well. It's available on any good podcast app and through the IPA website. And yeah, especially for that one, make sure you're leaving that 5-star review on iTunes. Really good way of getting people to the show. Last week, they had a really great conversation with historian Andrew Roberts about his new book, Churchill Walking with Destiny. So if you are a fan of Churchill and you want to hear more about him, do not miss that interview at all. Now, Nina, if people are listening to our podcast and they want to support the work that we're doing, we're going to be talking to Andrew Bushnell about his report coming up pretty soon, and they want to support the IPA, where can they go to become a member? And if they are a member, where can they go to donate?
You won't have to do this when you're at the ABC.
No, she still does. That's like
just get that's money, why give it to I'm them. There. Yeah. That's why, like, that's it'd the reason why I should be there.
Yeah, subliminal messaging. You're just doing IPA membership material halfway through Q&A.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So just visit our website, ipa.org.au, and click on the donate button if you like to donate. Or if you like to, even better, become a member, just click on the join button, and starting as low as $22 per year, you can become one of the Lotus Voice of Freedom in Australia.
Whoa, that was so energetic at the end. All right, let's go to those interviews now. Okay, we are now joined, a very exciting interview. We're now joined by Dr. Stephen Hicks, who is just about to come to Australia on his tour, Adventures in Postmodernism, hosted by True Arrow Events. So Stephen, we'll start there. So talk to us about your tour. What are you going to be discussing?
Well, talking about postmodernism, it's a very vigorous movement. Anyone who is in university, particularly in humanities or social sciences, is well aware of it. A very critical movement of most of the main institutions of Western civilization or global civilization right now. The modern world has largely been shaped by science and technology and liberal capitalism. And those of us who are in favor of those institutions are finding ourselves in vigorous debate with people who think science and technology are deeply suspicious or are very problematic fundamentally, and that certainly any sort of liberal capitalism is perhaps the devil destroying the world and needs to be replaced by something else, something postmodern.
Yeah, exactly. So where does postmodernism come from?
Mm. Well, my story is that it's complicated because it's trying to say that the entire modern world is a mistake, or that the entire modern world has led to a disaster. So what you find is that it's a multi-front critique. I mean, the things that have shaped the modern world have been beliefs in universal rights, that all human beings should have the same rights. But the postmoderns are somewhat jaded about that, right? Believing that there is no such thing as a universal human nature. Instead, we're defined by our racial identity or our gender identity or our ethnic identity. So from that perspective, they believe that just different groups have different values that are in collision with each other. So do we believe that freedom is a universal birthright, or do we think that's some sort of imperialist agenda that some groups are imposing on others? So politically, that's one of the major battles. Do we think that, say, a free market economy is bringing benefits to everyone in the world, more goods, better quality, lower prices, and so forth? Or, does a free market involve some sort of exploitation and disempowering certain groups? So that's another major debate, right, that we're in economically. Do we think that science and technology, also core institutions, right, of the modern world, are universally beneficial, or is the scientific way of thinking really just one group's way of thinking? It's a white male way of thinking or a Eurocentric way of thinking, and that different groups have different ways of thinking, and being non-scientific is appropriate. Perhaps religion is another defining institution. The religious toleration that has been a defining institution of the modern world. Can we learn that what one thinks and does in one's religious life should be a private individual matter, and we have to understand that lots of other people are going to think and behave differently, and as long as it's peaceful, basically anything goes in religion, right? Or do we see religion as something that is driven by passions and different groups, and so it's ultimately going to be just one more conflicting element, and we should not really expect peace and toleration to emerge? So the stakes are very high, and we're having this multi-front battle.
So you mentioned that, and what this might be of interest to a lot of our listeners, that this has particular sway at universities at the moment across the Western world. How does that play out? And give us some examples of that.
Well, plays out in lots of ways. One is in the form of speech codes. One of the defining institutions of the modern world has been an elimination of old-fashioned conservative censorship, in many cases based on religion or tradition, and the freeing up of individuals to think whatever they want, say whatever they want. The idea that, particularly in universities, we really should have vigorous arguments where basically anyone can say anything they want, any position can be criticized, any position can be advocated. And we believe that individuals then, by having gone through that process, can sort out for themselves what they as individuals think the truth is. So we give wide scope to free speech. So one way it comes out in the postmodern effect is that the postmoderns don't think certain things should be said, that they say some words, some beliefs are harmful to various other groups. And those groups that have been on the receiving end of certain historical injustices should be allowed to say things and should not be exposed to certain viewpoints. So you find a new form of censorship emerging. And this time it's not coming from, say, religious conservatives. It's coming from postmodern leftists. So kind of individual toleration, free speech people like myself are fighting a two-front battle in that respect.
Yeah, that to me is so interesting, that when you think about the free speech battles of like 50, 60 years ago, it was always like the conservative forces saying, oh, you can't say that and you can't make stuff fun about that. And now it's the left. I mean, like, We recently just had like the anniversary of Blazing Saddles, like one of my favorite movies of all time. And you just think there's no way they can make it today. You had like Mel Brooks impersonating a Native American. You had a lot of people dropping the N-word. There's no way you can make it today. And it would be because the left would say, you can't do that, you can't do that, you can't do that. What explains like this switch in the puritanicalism between, it's like it used to be conservative, now it's left.
Yeah, I cultural norms evolve across time, and I think I have no problem with people of our generation looking back at movies and music that were made generations ago and cringing. So I do think moral improvement and becoming more civil and respectful of differences and so forth is absolutely important. But as a liberal, in the proper sense of liberal, as I said, I think those cultural norms should evolve through peaceful discussion and convincing people that something really is inappropriate. What we find is that the postmoderns are much more jaded about the prospects for peaceful conversion and peaceful discussion, and they want to use forceful institutional methods just to say that you cannot do various things. So what you find is they will use, rather than say guilt and shame and pointing out to people as a social education process, you know, really that's hurtful to various other people. They're willing to drag you through a kind of inquisition, right, to get you kicked out of universities, or that you're going to fail various courses, or you're going to lose your job, right? Or in principle, if it becomes a government speech code, be arrested and fined and sent to prison. So any forceful attempt to massage the direction of social discourse, I think is one of our big battles, but I think it's very inappropriate.
We find with our work here in Australia that despite the best efforts of postmodernists, young people actually have a genuine thirst and desire for the great ideas of history and for the things you were talking about previously.
Absolutely.
Is that something, so that's something you've experienced as well?
I think that's a beautiful thing, right, about young people. They want their lives to be meaningful. They know that life is complicated, that there are many options open to them. And I think most of them realize that even if they're intelligent and well-read, that there have been a lot of smart people out there who've disagreed about all of those issues, and that the only way they're going to sort it out for themselves is by being exposed to the big ideas and by people who have very different viewpoints. So I think young people who want a genuine education, they go to university expecting that they will have very intelligent professors who disagree with each other, and they're going to be exposed to all of that. And I urge young students especially to do some homework on the universities that they go to, the departments, because they're not going to get it at some departments and some universities. In some departments, it's going to be actively discouraged. So they're going to have to be kind of education entrepreneurs for themselves to seek out those different viewpoints and make sure that they're in a position to make their own best life choices.
Okay, so I know we're not going to get into sort of how do we fix things at universities, because that's going to be a lot of what you're going to be speaking about on your tour with True Arrow Events here in Australia. But just so if there are so many young people out there who are open to new ideas and they're open to these new ways of thinking, they don't want to be forced into these bubbles, are you optimistic that that force is bigger than the people who are just going to blindly take what universities give them? Are they like what is the future of universities, do you think?
Yeah, that's a hard question about the motivation of incoming university students. A certain number of them are just looking for a credential, and you know they'll just accept whatever the university gives them. A certain number of them are just avoiding having to go out into the work world, so their motivation. But I do think that there's a significant number of people who realize that they want to make something of their lives and education that they hopefully are going to get at university. So I think if universities do not reform themselves, right, what should happen is that there will be various self-corrective mechanisms. And I can't speak to the Australian circumstance, but certainly in the United States, there are some of these self-corrections. Some of the worst of the departments are hemorrhaging students, because you know students come in, and if they realize that they are being fed a politically correct line, they will just drop the course and go somewhere else. And then the student grapevine kicks in and the numbers dwindle in those departments. Or universities that become too politically correct, if they are reliant on state funding, well, then they get pushback from the state organs that want to say, you know, unless you're actually doing genuine education, we're going to restrict your funding. Or many of the donors who are writing 100,000 dollar or million dollar checks to the universities. If it's the university they graduated from and they go back and visit and they realize what ridiculous authoritarian things are happening there, they stop writing the million dollar checks. And so there are feedback loops that are there. I think also with the internet and various online education forums and the whole explosion of YouTube, it's opening up new alternatives for young people who want to learn stuff to learn it at their own pace and to make sure that they're exposed to all of the kind of the maddening range of opinions that really are out there.
Yeah, that seems to be the case in the famous one, like the Evergreen State College, or which I can't remember its exact name, but that was the one where one of the
Evergreen, yes.
Yeah, yeah, and their enrollments are absolutely falling off a cliff. Like, it's just really not looking good for that university long term.
Right. Yeah. Yes, and so that's a smaller institution that is largely tuition driven. So every $50,000 a year student you lose, that sends a signal. University of Missouri is a large state institution, and it had major problems with an outbreak of race-based political correctness. It lost something on the order of 8,000 students in the following year. So those are the sorts of things that people pay attention to. And I do think, yeah, students and their parents, especially when they're shopping around for universities, they need to do their homework.
Yeah, yeah. Well, my brother's just about to head off to college in the U.S., and the University of Missouri came up, and it was a big, long discussion. Like, it's still a few years later. It's still something that people are talking about in enrollments.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting, all the way the other side of the world.
So just onto your tour, obviously we're going to be talking about your book, Postmodernism. Now, that got a huge rap from Jordan Peterson. That must have been pretty exciting to get.
Oh, yes. Jordan Peterson is doing great work. He comes from a different part of the political spectrum from where I do, but I'm very glad that he is out there. I think what we are finding in North America, and I'm hoping this is true in Australia, is that people who are more conservative, like Professor Peterson, people who are more left liberal, like, say, Steven Pinker and Jonathan Haidt, people who are more libertarian, like myself, however much we disagree with each other on lots of very big issues, we do recognize that there is a common problem, and that if higher education and intellectual life is going to survive, it means that we have to have the forum where we can have the arguments among people who are genuinely interested in having the arguments and sorting out the big issues. So, yeah, I'm very appreciative of on that front, being a strong ally of the kind of work that Professor Peterson is doing.
Very cool. All right, so we've got one last question for you. So we kind of covered around these areas, but we've got a lot of young listeners on this podcast, a lot of people who are just about to start uni or maybe are in uni at the moment. What would you tell them if they're about to start their liberal arts courses?
Yeah. What I would say is the really important thing is the thing that you know, and that is that your life is important. And you want to make something significant and meaningful, and that you're going to be devoting yourself to maybe a series of careers or maybe one career, preparing yourself for becoming a parent, for hopefully having a great romantic relationship. And that means that you are a work in progress and you need to become the best person that you possibly can be. And part of your university education should be exposing you to all of the great ideas, psychological, sociological, anthropological, and so forth, that are going to help you not only in your career, but in your personal life. So take that quest seriously, but at the same time, be aware that at university, you will be exposed to a large number of very cynical, very pessimistic people. And unfortunately, many of the professors you will meet are people who are burned out, who have bought into very cynical, jaded worldviews, who think that ultimately life is a power struggle and it's all ultimately futile. So listen to them, right? But be aware that jaded, cynical perspective can be countered. Consider it, but don't let it get too far into your soul.
Okay, brilliant. So Dr. Stephen Hicks, the tour is Adventures in Postmodernism. Go to truearrowevents.com for tickets. We've got events coming up pretty soon, so make sure you're going out and buying those tickets. Dr. Stephen Hicks, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Hey, guys, a pleasure to be with. Thanks for your questions.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we're now joined by research fellow Andrew Bushnell here at the IPA, one of the favorites of the podcast. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Now, let us talk, because you had an article in the Courier Mail, not yesterday, but the day before, I want to say. Maybe it was yesterday.
It was Monday.
What? Seamless. Seamless.
So what? Which day is today? Yesterday. Today's Tuesday. Today? So it was Monday. So right. It was yesterday.
This is a great start to an interview, but let's talk about it. So this is about incarceration in Queensland. So do you want to talk us through what your article was about?
Yeah, so the article was just about the findings from a report that was just put out by the Queensland Productivity Commission. I was lucky enough to talk to them during the process of putting together the report. So they, one of the guys writing the report gave me a call. So I was able to talk him through, you know, what we've been working on in criminal justice over the last 2.5 years. And then I put in like a submission that had, you know, a selection of some of our findings. And then anyway, this op-ed, after the report came out, I wrote this op-ed for the Courier Mail just with some of the key findings and pushing a couple of our lines.
Yeah, cool. So what's the report say? Like the Productivity Commission report?
Yeah, so the Productivity Commission report finds that the incarceration rate in Queensland has grown by about 44% since 2012, even though at the same time crime has declined. So what they're arguing is that there's a whole number of policy decisions that have been taken right throughout the criminal justice system that are leading to higher incarceration. And then because it's a Productivity Commission report, it's more in our wheelhouse and they start talking about the costs of that. So
yeah, I was just thinking Netflix's head of contents, George, has dropped hearing that 44, like incarceration's gone up but crime's gone down, means there's a lot of people behind bars that didn't do anything, which is 100% of Netflix recent.
every documentary they do. So they could come to Queensland and try and figure this out for us.
Yeah. But let's talk about your article. So what are the policy decisions that are making so many people incarcerated?
Yeah, so there's a couple that have really fed into this. And one is the problem of remand. Well, it's not really a problem. I mean, so the idea of remand is that when someone is charged with a crime, a decision has to be made about whether this person can be released into the community or not. And you have more and more people being remanded into custody, which means that a determination is being made either by the court or by the police that these people aren't safe to be in the community. Now, there's a couple of things that you could sort of do to limit that because it's actually really expensive to remand someone into prison in the order of several hundred dollars a day plus transport costs and all those sorts of things. So, I mean, you could do, you know, things like take more advantage of some of the technological developments we've seen in recent years. So GPS monitoring is much more reliable, which makes monitoring people in the community much less costly and much safer. So, you know, that's one thing. Then there's some other decisions. So police prosecuting more crimes, taking more crimes to court. And then there's this issue that we're a little bit more interested in here, which is this idea of short prison sentences. So what the QPC report found was that the median sentence length, so that's the middle, if you lined up every sentence that had been doled out in a line, the middle one is just 3.9 months. So what that says is that, you know, it's not a lot of time to correct anyone's behaviour. But for those 4 months, this person is surrounded by other criminals and, you know, deprived of the sort of networks of family and work or anything else that might support him in his normal life. And so you're kind of getting the bad effect of prison, which is this changing the way people behave without any possibility of the rehabilitative side of that, so changing some of their existing bad habits because you just don't have enough time. So, you know, what we argue is that at least some of those people who are going to prison for short time, they're going to prison for a short period of time because they've committed less serious non-violent offending. You know, and this is, you know, petty theft, low-level drug offending.
Counterfeiting. Sorry, you weren't here for that part of the show, but that got brought up earlier.
I don't know what the penalty is for counterfeiting. Do I need to look this up for anyone?
Yeah, actually, if you've been doing it any good.
Pete's great.
I have an op-ed out there. Yeah, don't put Pete Gregory in jail for counterfeiting. Well,
if he got it was my great-great-uncle got sent to Australia for counterfeiting.
Oh, he's a very enterprising fellow.
I mean, well, really, if he'd got a community order, though, I wouldn't exist. So,
But that's a strong free market gene, right? I mean, we're not that's entirely right. Sold on the idea of like a central government currency
that's,
anyway.
That's the argument he made, actually. did not fly, but that's all right.
So, you know, you've got these short prison sentences for people who maybe, I mean, like a significant number of these people, given the technological developments that we've seen, given the availability of other forms of punishment for them, like bolstering community service, which I've spoken about a little bit in the past, given that these are other options, if we deploy them, then we can save a bunch of money. I mean, that's the idea.
You noted in your piece that from people who return to prison within 2 years after their prison term has increased from 29% up to 40% in the last decade. That's obviously part of what you're talking about.
Yeah, so one of the drivers of this increase in incarceration has been what we call reoffending or reincarceration, so that the rate of people who get released from the criminal justice system, and it turns out the criminal justice system hasn't actually corrected their behaviour, and they go back to crime and they commit another crime, and then we go through this whole cycle again with all the costs along the way. Because it's not just the cost of punishment, you know, it's the cost of the victim, and it's the cost of society, then it's the cost of catching people, the cost of police to try and stop crime, the cost of prosecution. So right throughout the system, there's all these costs along the way. And when the reoffending rate goes up like this, what you're saying, you're just cycling more and more people through the system, picking up costs along the way and raising this question of, well, what could the system do differently to correct their behaviour? And that's actually a nice segue, because that's what I'm working on right now, which is right now I'm writing about the possibility that private prison contracts can be written in a way that encourages lower rates of reoffending. It's kind of an interesting innovation in prisons over the last ten years. Here in New Zealand, the United Kingdom has trialled it as well. And basically, the idea is that as part of the contract that you have with a prison operator, you make part of their payment dependent on their performance against a reoffending metric.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, what I'm arguing is that there's reasons to believe that this can work. There's ways that it might be able to work. The current contracts that we're seeing probably aren't optimised for this, which kind of reflects the system's, I guess, low priority that it attaches to reducing reoffending. So that's like the macro argument, I guess, is that along with incapacitating criminals, which means taking them off the streets and punishing them for what they do, we also want to sort of elevate in that discussion this idea of corrections, taking that more seriously. What would it mean to, you know, correct someone's behaviour from a transgressive path to a normal path?
So one of the things you've talked about is community service, and you say that people in Queensland on average get, 64 hours of community service, but only end up doing 30 hours of them on average?
Yeah.
Is that something that...
So, yeah, I think that's really serious, that if, you know, we want to reduce incarceration or reduce the growth of incarceration at the very least, then we need alternatives. And the main alternative punishment that exists is community service. People will be familiar with this idea. You know, you see people, you know, sometimes cleaning parks, public spaces, removing graffiti, this kind of work. But as it turns out, you know, there's not always enough of that work. It's not always available. And so a lot of people who are sentenced to do, you know, a certain number of hours, they're released having done only a fraction of those hours because there's just not enough work for them to do, and there's no point in keeping them hanging around. And so in Queensland, yeah, this problem is pretty acute. It's people serve less than half of the hours that they're sentenced to on average. And what, the policy idea that I've come up with for this is, I think we want to, you know, noting that the problem is the quality and quantity of the work available, it'd be good to get some different organisations involved in providing this kind of work. So at the moment, it's limited to government-run work and volunteer community organisation type work. I think that there is some scope for allowing for-profit businesses to take some of these people on as workers and split the cost of their labour between the government and the company. And that way, you know, you'd have access to more work, better quality work, and there'd be a material reward connected to the work for the offenders, which we know is actually part of correcting their behaviour, is getting them to realise, you know, that there's an incentive to do the right thing, you know, an immediate reward for doing the right thing. And that's what, because that's what we want. I mean, that's how the rest of us live our lives, right? You get up in the morning, you go to work, you get a pay packet, you live your own life.
Yep.
That's what we want.
Absolutely. All right. So the article is available on ipa.org.au. So go check it out. Andrew Bushnell in the Courier Mail. And we'll keep an eye out for that report when it comes out. Now, we'll move on to another topic I know is near and dear to your heart. And that is the Oscars coming up. The nominees have been released. The BAFTAs just happened. Mm. And
good name, that. BAFTA.
Yeah.
It's fun to say.
It's fun to say. Do you have any thoughts on that? No. You were telling me the other day that there's a few films that got nominated which you think wouldn't be that deserving.
Yeah, I think, you know, I wouldn't be the only person to have noticed that every year the field gets more and more political. And so it seems that they deal with a narrower range of topics. But I think we have a specific disagreement, do we not, James, about the film Roma? Alfonso Cuarón.
I haven't watched enough films to say it's the best movie of the year, but I have watched that film and it is a good film. I really enjoyed it. So
yeah, so everyone's saying, so this is a movie, just so people know, this is a movie made by the Mexican film director Alfonso Cuarón about, ostensibly it's been called like a personal reflection on his life growing up as a Mexican middle-class person in Mexico City and the relationship of his family with their indigenous maid, and the film follows her through a quite trying period in her life. And the film is, you know, very affecting, I think, in parts, and I think it's well acted. It's beautiful to look at. I mean, like all of Cuarón's movies.
Yeah, there's some amazing set pieces. One of them I want to ask you about a bit later, but continue. Yeah,
so there's a butt coming, you know.
Yeah,
so
big butt.
and the butt for me is that the movie is sort of been portrayed in the media as like a really personal movie, but I think it's actually not a particularly introspective movie. I don't think it really interrogates the role that people like Cuarón and his family played in the unrest that it depicts. So the film wants to, you know, be sympathetic to this working class indigenous maid and kind of criticise, I think, this liberal middle class family. You know, the dad's a doctor and the mum's a professor. But it doesn't really get into, as the movie develops, there's kind of like a student uprising that takes place in the background. And the student uprising, you know, it's not really depicted in the movie, but like in real life, that's a communist uprising, right? And the government that they were protesting against was a socialist government, not a democratic one, a socialist government that had come to power about 40 years before the events in the movie and ruled for another 20 years after that. With the support of families like Cuarón.
Well,
I think it shows that someone like Alfonso Cuarón, he's always on the side of bourgeois globalism rather than the side of the working class, despite his posturing. He doesn't want to connect.
There we go. There it is.
So, long story short, but here it is. I mean, the thing about it is that it's the attitudes of, you know, the educated, liberal, left, sort of soft left middle class that makes this kind of left-wing violence possible. I think in the end, he sort of inadvertently reinforces attitudes that lead to these destructive behaviours that he ostensibly wants to decry.
Okay.
And I kind of take this like left-wing violence a bit personally, particularly in Latin American context, because my wife, who's Peruvian, she grew up in Lima, but had to move from Lima to the north of Peru when there was sort of similar left-wing violence taking place in that city, right? So like a bomb failed to detonate just outside her childhood home.
Ooh.
And that was like the last straw for Melissa and her family, and they moved to the north.
Yeah, it's a pretty good last straw. Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of like, I think more could have been said in this movie, not just about the connection between the politics of Cuarón and his family and the politics that we're seeing on the streets, but also it could have been made clearer how alienated the central figure in this story is from these events that are taking place around her. Now, there are parts in the movie where you do kind of see this distance, that her life is distant from these events. So, for example, the key moment in her life when she's giving birth, there's all this violence happening around her at the time. But for me, it just didn't land. And I think that's because Quaron doesn't really want to indict himself or his family. And I think that's, you know, so it's not really a personal movie.
Okay. And right. That's reflected in the people that give out these awards.
So that's
as well.
Kind of a long-winded explanation, but this is what was going through my head. Like, as I was watching the movie, because it is like a gorgeous movie and it's really thought-provoking. I actually started making sort of notes as I was watching it, because I was like, this is really like bizarre that there's like this gap, I think, in the politics of this movie. And perhaps, you know, perhaps if I watch it again and I don't get distracted by that thought process.
There is no way that's going to happen.
No, I'll probably have this. I'll just run through it again.
Now, I want to keep us to one campaign launch per podcast. Yeah. We've already started Nina to host Q&A. But I wouldn't mind a future campaign launch, Andrew Bushnell as Oscar's ombudsman. He comes out after every award. No, I just reckon ombudsman. He comes out after every award is announced and explains why that award winner was unworthy.
I'm like Kanye.
Yeah. You're just permanently Kanye.
just get off stage.
Yeah, but you won't let them finish at all. All right. Andrew, so check out the article on the Career Mail and on our website, ipa.org.au, and we'll have you back on when that report's come out to discuss it then. So,
awesome.
Andrew, thanks
Cheers.
So much
Thank
for
you.
Us.
Thanks, mate.
Okay, thank you to Dr. Stephen Hicks and Andrew Bushnell for those interviews. All right, let's get into some stories that have made us laugh this week. Yeah. Oh, actually, first off, I've got to give another shout out. True Arrow Events, go to them. They're all your Stephen Hicks ticket needs.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get into some stories that have made us laugh this week. And I got sent this an hour ago, so hot off the press.
Mm-hmm.
It's very silly, so we don't need to spend a whole lot of time on it. But if I may, Pete.
Go for it, mate.
All right. So we've got a tweet here from Alison Caden, who is a reporter with PIX11. So a news organization in New York. She was in Bloomingdale's, big department store in the US. She's found a T-shirt. T-shirts are yellow and it says fake news on it. She tweets, "Hey Bloomingdale's, this isn't funny or fashionable. It further delegitimizes hardworking journalists who bring real news to their communities." And the best part is Bloomingdale's have tweeted back saying, "We are now looking into removing the shirt."
If they remove it, I will cancel my Bloomingdale's club membership.
I'll order 47 of these shirts right now.
Yeah.
Just to stick it to people.
So what? So she's presumably one of these journalists bringing real news to the hard
I would say that she sees herself as such. Well, and there's all these shirts around Bloomingdale saying fake news, which undermine her each and every single day. Delegitimizing her.
Yeah,
Whomst among us has not looked at a shirt and thought, this gives journalism less credit?
Yeah, whomst.
Whomst among us.
Can I ask a question? What has been the reaction on social media?
It seems to be majority making fun of her.
Okay.
So,
ratioed as the kids say.
Well, it hasn't been ratioed as much as, engaged with, I would say.
But this is why Twitter look after them. They bring traffic through.
Yes. And Bloomingdale's might actually crumble. I was going to think, if this is the way we're going to now approach this, those T-shirts where it's like my grandma went to Bristol and all I got was this lousy T-shirt. Mm. That makes fun of Bristol and it makes fun of grandmas. And to be honest, also makes fun of T-shirts.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it does.
So really, we should scrap those.
Yep.
I'm with stupid. Look at that. I mean, what further delegitimizes stupid people than T-shirts pointing out their stupidity? So those have to go as well.
Well, I mean, obviously, there's lots of stuff that we have to start to think about.
We have to have a discussion.
Yeah.
I like saying that. Yeah. We have to have a discussion later when I've prepared.
Yeah. A broader discussion. No, okay. So that's well brought up, James. That's good. I saw a piece in Fairfax during the week, which everyone will be interested in. It was about a survey that took place in Australia during the week or recently, which talked about people who didn't want to have children because of climate change. Here's a quote from a woman who said she didn't want to have children because of climate change. "It's definitely something I've thought about when considering making that very big decision. It's not the only factor, of course, but it's a big factor because I want to consider the future for that potential child, and it's looking like it will be very damaging. Then it's something I've got to weigh up before deciding whether or not to bring them into the world. According to a national survey of 6,500 women, a third of those below the age of 30 have similar concerns. The survey, conducted towards the end of last year by the Australian Conservative Foundation and Climate Action Group, 1 million women, reached thousands of women through social media and the membership networks of both organisations. 33.4% of women aged under 30 said they're having second thoughts." I think if you're having second thoughts about having kids because of climate change, that's probably for the best.
Yep.
That's probably okay. I can see why AOC's Green New Deal is so popular now.
Yes.
Because, you know, we've saved
that's
the climate.
That's how we pay for it. It's not paying, it doesn't pay for itself with more money, but it's just going to unleash an absolute tidal wave of new children who are going to pay income tax.
Well, I mean, all these people are like, come on, babe, let's go celebrate. Because that's what it means.
Come on, babe, let's go celebrate.
That's what it means.
Dad, Mum, how did you know you wanted to have a child?
Well, we got the new deal.
All right. Okay, I got another one here. So in China, new anime has been released and it's quite popular. And it is on the anime-rich and storyline-rich and television-rich topic of the life and times of Karl Marx.
Ooh, yeah.
So it's called The Leader. It's a 7-episode show. It is a production by the Communist Party's propaganda apparatus. They've taken stock of the situation. They've realized that long-form, deep discussions about communist ideology and the life of Karl Marx ain't exactly cutting it with the kids these days, so they need to get into the anime market themselves.
Let's sex him up.
Yeah, sex him up. So it's a love story. It's all these other things. Karl Marx is an absolute dreamboat in that show.
Is he?
They are taking a page out of the Sexy Stalin. I don't know if you've seen that.
No.
But boy, oh boy, did Stalin do some good posthumous work for himself in the last few years when that photo of him in his 20s comes out.
Really?
Guy had really good hair. To be honest, look it up.
Did they fake that or something?
I don't think so. I think he just...
Oh, I think... Okay.
27, he had some pretty damn good hair. Anyway, so Karl Marx show, anime, pretty funny. So the best part is, though, that subscribers to the communist propaganda network in which it's on get to watch the next episode before anyone else does.
Well...
So just to update you on this communist propaganda show about Karl Marx... If you pay more, you have access to more services.
Well,
I just want everyone to know.
Just to reiterate. That if you pay
more, better services about communism.
On technology.
On technology about propaganda.
Well, that is ironic, James.
I can't wait for the episode. I might even sign up for the subscription episode where Karl Marx refuses to acknowledge that he's the father of his housemaid's child.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Which is the anime rich stuff you need when you start discussing beautiful Karl Marx.
I'm not sure if that'll make the final cut. So it was viewed more than 2.8 million times in less than a day.
Is that a lot? That's a lot in Australia. In China, I don't think that's a lot.
No, not in China.
Yeah.
That's probably like 0.01%.
Not exactly dominating the water cooler.
Yeah,
I think it just sounds like a lot, and then you get into the weeds. And
it's like those sort of cancel ads that they make in Australia.
Yeah,
but I did see a couple of comments from watchers. Someone wrote, "This Marx is so cute."
Was that me?
Is cute? No, that wasn't. Well, I mean, mate, potentially. And another person wrote, presumably this was a young man. Marx is teaching you how to seduce a girl. Must take notes.
All right.
So,
I don't think that's what Marx was trying to do.
That's not what he was going for.
That's not his lasting impact on the world.
But, you know, make of it what
that
you will.
That would be funny if, like, somehow Karl Marx comes back to Earth and just, like, people think he's a pickup artist. Yeah. And he's like, hang on, what?
Yeah. Anyway, so that's how some people are taking it.
All right, cool. So, speaking of idealizing fallen figures.
Yeah.
So Christopher Pine, Member of Parliament, gave an interview to the Australian this week, Pete. And do you want to talk about it?
Yes, I will talk about that, James. The question for you is Malcolm Turnbull Aslan?
The mythical lion from Lion, the Witch, and the... No, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe?
That's it, yes. So, C.S. Lewis, Chronicles of Narnia, the most famous of which is, of course, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Okay.
I see similarities, but I wouldn't say they're the same.
Yeah, okay. Well, Defence Minister Christopher Pine had an interview with the Sydney Morning Herald yesterday that prompted headlines because he said... In relation to Turnbull getting the knife, I felt that the constant social media shouty segment of the press that keeps everyone on edge in this building all the time and might not actually reflect at all the way the public think had won, and that since people had bowed to irrational pressure. On prompt reflection, that's not the most interesting bit. The most interesting bit is the next bit when he said, and I found it very disappointing that too many of my colleagues didn't see Malcolm in what I saw and still see in Malcolm. Malcolm is Aslan to me.
I also like that Christopher Pine then goes on to say that he is... Hang on, let me get the full quotes because there's a lot here.
It's important.
I think Malcolm is the kind of person that should have been Prime Minister of Australia. Urbane, highly intellectual, successful, broad, visionary, clever, articulate, funny, charming, everything that a modern leader and a modern Prime Minister should be. That is a lot of adjectives.
It is a lot.
I also like, so you say how he's like, how does none of my colleagues see the Malcolm that I see? It's like, if you're only disappointed in your colleagues for not seeing that Malcolm... You are going to be disappointed in so many more people. Like, there are so many people in Australia that you're about to be disappointed in.
Well, you know, 30-odd news polls in a row.
Yeah.
No, Aslan is meant to be Jesus. Did we point that out?
Yeah, so Aslan is like this mythical Jesus-like figure.
Yeah,
so,
like he's literally meant to represent Jesus Christ.
Yeah, yeah. But there are two things that about Aslan in Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, if my memory serves me correctly, that can relate to Malcolm Turnbull.
Mm-hmm.
One, kind of aloof. Aslan doesn't really show up until the very end. And that's the other thing I was going to say. Like, Aslan only seemed in the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. Aslan only seemed to be there in the good times.
Okay.
There were some pretty heavy battle sequences.
Well,
where it's like, man, it would be really good to have that Christ-like lion figure show up.
That's true. He did breathe life back into one of them. Look, we're going to have to go back over this.
Look, I wasn't very big into fantasy novels.
There's a couple of plot... there's a couple of plot bits that we've missed.
Yeah.
But that... Don't blame us.
No, I think that's a pretty thorough analysis of Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe.
It's a great
I have one question.
Okay.
Malcolm Turnbull was a bit of a darling of Q&A.
Yes, he was.
Now, Aslan is a lion.
Yes, now, he Nina, is.
Would you, Nina Loanata, as the new host of Q&A, have a live lion on the show?
No.
Well, I'm trying to set you up here, right? Who's not watching Q&A? It's like, oh, we got four... panelists and a lion.
This is your angle, Nina.
It's my angle.
Who's not watching four panelists and a lion?
Yeah, well, exactly. My policies like do not work with live animals.
Yeah, well, the live animals don't work with other panelists. That's what I'm tuning in for.
Anyway, something for Nina to consider.
Well, I reckon more lion content would help the Nina Law and Arthur Q&A. All right, that is it for this show this week. Thank you again to Dr. Stephen Hicks. Make sure you're
going. Don't we have to talk about one more thing?
You are such a good host. All right, you catch me when I fall.
Okay.
That's what you do.
Which is why...
we're sharing an office together. Yes. So, here at the IPA, there are some brief renovations going on, which has forced the hand of upper management...
Forced the hand of the powers that be.
Of the powers that be to reorganize a few seating positions here at the IPA. So, yeah. Pete and I were separate,
mm-hmm.
and now we are together. We are sharing an office together.
Very together.
Very, very together. Very close quarters.
Yep.
So, I reckon a good recurring segment on this show... in between, can we get Nina to host Q&A?
Yeah.
Is going to be Pete and James review each other as office buddies.
Yeah.
So week one, how are we feeling? It's only been 2 days.
Like, I think we're still in the honeymoon period. I just feel like I'm back at school.
Yeah.
And there's...
You've said that numerous times.
I feel like specifically like year nine. That's the level. That's where we're at in the office at the moment.
Yeah. Productivity, I'm gonna say it. It's taking a hit.
Okay, so, wouldn't have said that.
Well, you just compared us to being in year nine.
It was a productive time in my life. Like, I don't know what you mean.
I would shudder to see you in year 10 if year nine was a productive time in your life based on what we've done this week.
Because, I mean, we don't, you know, it's good to see you do your thing in close quarters, though, you know, to see you go through.
So Pete compares it to year nine.
Yeah.
I have a problem.
Okay. I mean, now, like, this is
I've got a lot of problems. One specifically to this problem is, and this is going to be hard for people to get their head around because it's going to be expressed in an audio format.
Mm-hmm.
But the desk that Pete and I are sitting across, the computer screen that divides us only goes up to about our brow.
Yeah.
So permanently, I just see the top of Pete's head all day. And you would see the top of mine.
Well,
and occasional eye contact.
Yeah.
There's so much eye contact.
It's... too much.
How is it? Looking at each other's eyes.
I'm struggling right now, and it's only been 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's just a lot of eye contact.
Yep. So
something to note.
It's going
to
be a long 8 to 10 weeks.
All right, cool. Now, that is it for the show this week. Thank you again to Dr. Stephen Hicks and Andrew Bushnell for those interviews. True Arrow Events, that's where you want to go if you want some tickets to Dr. Stephen Hicks' shows when he's in Australia. And ipa.org.au, that's where you want to go if you want to read Andrew Bushnell's work on criminal justice.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you guys so much for listening and downloading to this podcast on all the podcast platforms that you do. Make sure you're telling your friends and family about the show. Always great to get some new listeners and get some more people to hear what the IPA is all about. Make sure you're spreading the word. And if you are listening through iTunes, make sure you're leaving us that 5-star review. Really helps us out with the rankings. And you can also leave the comment. What did we settle on? It was Nina for QA.
Well, I like the people's host.
People's host. Either one. Comment that. Tweet it. Facebook it. Do whatever you need to do. We are going to get Nina on Q&A.
Let's start a movement.
Start a revolution.
Let's get primary school kids to skip school and protest
Nina. Or we start a revolutionary movement and 200 years from now, the Chinese government makes an anime show about us.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be awesome.
And then we get to be really good looking. Yeah, but we'll be main characters. We'll be characters.
No, yeah, sure, sure.
We'll be whitewashed out of history.
Yeah, yeah. Like, me will be the center.
No, it'll be the Nina
characters
show.
And the posters, and you guys will be in, like, comic right relief. And left.
Yeah.
At the back, like, you know, like supporting characters.
Yeah, comic
yeah.
relief.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, like, when your plot lines get a little heavy, me and Peach just come in and trip over ourselves, and suddenly everyone's laughing again.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Where are we at? See you guys next week.
See you later.